Al Shepard, Captain, United States Navy, the first American to go into space, and now you're on the way to the moon. Just for our listeners, Al, tell us just a bit about your background. What part of the United States do you come from originally?
Well, I come from New England, state of New Hampshire, actually. I was born there, went through high school in New Hampshire, then went away to the Naval Academy for my undergraduate training, joined the Navy, started flying, and I've been flying ever since.
And you were one of the original Mercury 7 astronauts. Do you remember anything interesting about how you were selected? Did you know the other six at that time?
I knew two of the other six that at the time of our selection, but I don't know. It was a fairly involved process. They looked inside our brains, they examined our bodies, and looked at our background, and kind of put everything all together.
Do you think it's changed now in the current selection process?
It's pretty much the same. There's been, as perhaps you know, there's been emphasis in the early days on piloting ability, and in the later days on scientific background as an experience prior to being selected. I think this certainly reflects the advance in technology associated with spaceflight over the past 12 years since the original selection. But the selection process is pretty much the same. I think it's a valid one. You take a look at what a guy's specialty is, first of all. You take a look at how well he has performed, and if he's performed well in his own specialty, it's a pretty safe assumption he's going to perform well as an astronaut. Mm-hmm. And you take a look to see how healthy he is. It's pretty much the way we do it.
Has this 10 years passed quite fast for you since your first flight?
Oh, tremendously, yeah. Been an extremely busy time, of course, for all of us, but the time certainly hasn't dragged. It seems like only yesterday.
Before you became commander of this crew and began specific preparations, you were the chief of the astronauts over there in the headquarters near here. Mm-hmm. Just summarize your activities there in running that area for several years, throughout the rest of the Gemini and Apollo programs.
You know, actually, there were two of us involved, Deke Slayton and myself. Deke was also in the original group. And during the time period to which you refer, Deke was kind of responsible for the equipment and the airplanes that we fly, the training equipment and so on, and I was kind of responsible for the administrative functions and problems of the astronauts themselves, and the two of us kind of worked together to handle those activities in those days. It was primarily an administrative office type function, although I did stay active in flying airplanes, mm-hmm. and in keeping up on the general development of spacecraft hardware.
And you and Slayton were both part of the group which selected new astronauts, weren't you?
That's correct.
Mm-hmm. It must be exciting to be ready to go again.
Well, I think it's exciting, yeah.
Is it?
It's a little too early to really start the adrenaline flowing, because if I did, I wouldn't make it to the end of the month. I don't have that much adrenaline.
Okay, good luck.
But we're happy about it. We're looking forward to it.
Good luck, Al, throughout the mission.
Thank you.
Al Shepard, you look to be in mighty good shape for this flight. It was almost 10 years ago that you began the American manned space program with your first suborbital flight in Mercury. How do you keep in shape? What do you do?
Well, I primarily jog, although it's rather distasteful to me. I find that jogging a couple of miles every day that I can is perhaps the best, quickest way to keep me in reasonably good condition. I lift a few weights, not anything real heavy, but
you still do a lot of
weights.
You still do a lot of flying too, don't you? To keep your air.
I don't think flying per se is a conditioning process. I really think that you have to, and the experts agree that you really have to force the cardiovascular system to operate at a pretty good rate for 10 or 15 minutes in order to keep generally good condition.
There's been a lot of good-natured teasing, which you've responded to, about the fact that now at the age of 47 you will be the oldest astronaut to go into space, a bit older than some of the Russian cosmonauts who were in their mid-40s. You're now 47 years old, and you look good. The doctors say you're good. And you tell me about the kidding. Anybody give you a hard time?
Well, I don't really mind about the kidding. I think probably before too long, perhaps another 3 or 4 years, there'll be somebody who goes into space that'll be older than I currently am. As a matter of fact, I wouldn't mind being the first astronaut over 50 in space.
It's a matter of how you are in your head and how you keep your body, huh?
Yeah, that's it.
Okay, Al, good luck throughout the flight. This is Rhett Turner in Houston.
The checkout of the spacecraft systems the last few minutes is definitely minimal. The switches that have to be thrown by the crew have already been thrown. The systems have been pretty well checked out. There are a number of small functions that have involved throwing switches and reading specific instruments just to assure ourselves at the last minute that everything is still in good shape. But really, it's kind of a quiet time the last few minutes.
But you got to keep busy so that you don't get nervous or something, don't you?
I don't know how anybody could possibly stay busy enough not to get nervous at a time like that.
Mm-hmm.
As you pointed out earlier, of course, there are some communications checks the last few minutes that are made.
Do the simulations, do the countless rehearsals that you conduct really put you in a point of complete relaxation and calm other than just the knowledge that here we go?
Perhaps I've misled you. I don't think anybody that's flown has been completely relaxed and calm since the year one. And I don't know any other way to reduce that to a minimum than the way you've just suggested. As a matter of fact, I think that using these simulators and the realism that's provided in the use of them is such that you sort of get nervous when you think about crashing even with a simulator, that it is that effective a tool. And they really give an individual the feeling that says, well, you've been there before, kind of a thing. You have the feeling that you've been landing on the moon before, you've been taking off from the Cape before. That, of course, is not completely true, but it gives you the feeling that this is the case, and that helps to reduce the concern that everybody has.
Mm-hmm. Really, it's a relief once you're off and going, isn't it?
Yes.
I can hear your voice right now during that first part of the liftoff from your first flight. I've heard it so many times. We'll be hearing it again. Thank you very much, Al.
You're welcome.
When the lunar module begins to descend to the surface of the moon, Al, would you describe for us this powered descent from PDI to touchdown?
Well, it's a deorbit maneuver. It's an orbit. It's a maneuver to bring the spacecraft out of lunar orbit, which is, although it's asymmetric, it's not too far from being a circular type orbit. And of course, the spacecraft is essentially horizontal. We're on our backs, looking away from the center of the moon, with the engine pointed toward the landing site, and it is therefore a retrograde maneuver, a slowing down maneuver. And the engine continues to burn during the time period of the total descent, gradually slowing the spacecraft down to the point where it comes in and touches down in a vertical landing.
At the beginning, you see nothing but sky out the window then, the black of the sky, is that right?
Well, there are stars out
there.
Stars,
yeah. All right.
And you're watching. In fact, the stars are used to help verify the alignment of the spacecraft.
And Antares is one of them?
Antares is one of the stars. And The lunar surface itself is not observed during this particular phase, because we look at it a long time orbiting around before that. But every chance we get, every time we go by it, we look at it. But during the descent itself, we don't look at the landing site actually until approximately 8 minutes and 30 seconds into the descent, in which the pitch over occurs. Mm-hmm. And then it appears at the bottom of the window.
Mm-hmm. And is that the point at which you begin to make use of your landing point designator, the LPD?
That's correct.
Graph.
If it's ever going to be used at all, that'll be used right then, because the corrections that have to be made, if corrections have to be made, the earlier they are made after that pitch over maneuver, the less expensive it is as far as fuel use is concerned.
What modes are you planning to use from this point on, from pitch over on till touchdown?
Well, after the pitch over occurs, we'd like to stay with the with the main computer in the automatic control mode down to a height of perhaps 900 or 1,000 feet. Actually, we're cleared to use any of the control modes. Really, a lot of things can fail after this point, and the landing can still be continued.
Mm-hmm.
But hopefully, we'll hope to stay with the primary computer in the automatic control mode down to an altitude of somewhere around 900 or 1,000 feet, perhaps, at which point the landing from there on down will be essentially manually controlled.
Mm-hmm. And you rehearse all of these modes enough so that you can make quick decisions on their use. This is one of the crucial parts of this preparation at this for this particular phase, isn't it?
That's right. Yeah, it turns out that it's not too much of a problem to tell when a control mode has failed. The failure modes are primarily very obvious. The vehicle starts to pitch, yaw, or roll off its intended attitude at a fairly rapid rate. So there's not much question when a control mode has failed.
Now everyone here on Earth is listening to you. We can hear you and Ed Mitchell as you talk to each other. Do you get much support at that time, or is it planned for you to receive instructions from Earth at that point? Or is it all within the lunar module itself?
No, they can help us a great deal, of course, with assessing the value of such things as the performance of the primary and the secondary computers and the guidance systems on the way downhill. And they do that. Up to the point of pitchover. After pitchover, their contributions are primarily in the areas of the operation of the radar in helping us in the event we get any program alarms in the computers, these kind of things.
I understand you have a new program, a new model of the surface, which will enable that landing radar to give you a little more smoothed out reading as you descend.
That's the thesis, yes, that the new model of the terrain will improve the landing radar inputs to the computer trajectory.
Good luck on that touchdown, and we'll be listening to you on the surface, Al.
Thank you.
This is Rhett Turner in Houston. Al, during the first lunar surface activity, you and Ed Mitchell will primarily be deploying the experiments package. Would you tell us the things you think will be most interesting about this first experience?
Well, as you point out, the first excursion on the surface is to deploy, to set out, and put in operation the scientific instruments. This has always been the highest priority of our lunar surface activity. It's the same on our particular flight as it has been. Although we will use the little golf cart or rickshaw device, whatever you want to call it.
The MET, the Mobile Equipment Transporter, the cart.
That's. Okay, there you are. Anyway, that thing.
I'm with you.
Although we'll use it during the first excursion, its contribution there is not as great as it will be later on. But we will take it out nonetheless with us as we go out to the landing site. And as in the past, it's planned to be a two-man job. Certain of the pieces of equipment Ed will put out, and others I will put out.
Mm-hmm. When you step off the ladder onto the surface, will you have deployed the TV camera in such a way that we can see you fairly clearly?
No. The television camera will not be operated and turned on until after we get out.
Mm-hmm.
Well, as a matter of fact, that's one of the first things I do once the MESA table, that is the table that holds the lunar surface equipment, once that has been dropped, one of the first things I do is to put the television camera on a tripod and move it away, focus it back toward the ladder, so that as we deploy all this equipment, it'll be available, visible on television.
Mm-hmm. And then, in summarizing the first EVA, the first extravehicular activity, the ALSEP deployment and use of the Thumper package. Now, will you be making any sort of readings while Ed Mitchell is performing those thumpings coming in from the outer
No,
geophone.
As it turns out, during the time that Ed is using making that active seismograph experiment, thumping, if you will, I'm supposed to be quiet, at least for the first part of that operation. These little seismometers are supposed to be sensitive enough so that they will record our footsteps at that close range. So we have a little deal worked out. When Ed gets ready to take another or make another thump, then I have to stand quiet, let everything settle down. He thumps, and then we have another 5 seconds of a quiet time period until all the vibrations have died down. So I'll be stopping and waiting just like he is with each thump. But I'm generally involved in taking pictures of the total scientific array at that particular time, going around documenting the level of the bubbles and the level of the direction of the shadows and this sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. In the second EVA, what do you think is the most important part of your scheduled activity? What do you expect to be the most interesting?
Well, I guess things that we can see and touch and pick up will be the most interesting to us. Mm-hmm. If you're talking about on-the-spot interest,
you should be able to see
most of
the
experiments, right? the collection of the rocks, and most of the things that we do during the second EVA, of course, are very carefully analyzed, and the results and the determined days, weeks, months, and even years later. From our point of view, I think the most interesting thing will certainly be to get up on the top of Cone Crater to look at it. It's got to be an impressive thing. It's a 900, 1,000 feet across and 300 feet deep. You know, it's more than just a little hole out in your backyard. So it's got to be impressive. Mm-hmm. I think that'll certainly capture our interest. The size of the boulders around the rim of Cone Crater have got to be kind of wild. So there'll be a lot of interesting things right up there in the vicinity of the rim of that crater.
Thanks very much, Al Shepard.
You're welcome.
Good luck.